Mad. Mark after dark. The man that hates everything except the real thing. Coming to you once again, live on the air. Tonight on the program, I have a very special guest. Lips of Anvil. Before we get started, I wanted to tell you how great it is to see and hear that Anvil is finally getting the recognition it deserves.
Yeah, feels good, man.
It should. Okay, well, let me start asking you. How would you compare playing now to back in 1983?
There's a level of confidence that was never there.
Mm-hmm.
The two of the original members, I never felt completely confident in their performances. And at that particular time, I don't think that, I think that that's sort of part of the equation as to why things ended up the way they did.
Okay.
As examples of that, we were set to play the Philadelphia Spectrum with Aerosmith, and all the labels were coming to see us, and the night before the party was raging, so to speak, and I was begging them, guys, go to bed, man, we got an important night tomorrow night. And sure enough, when we went out, they're puking people behind their stacks and not performing very well, and I don't know, I never felt the level of security and confidence that exist in what I'm doing now.
Okay. Well, I just remember seeing Anvil back then at Lemoore's and everywhere opening up for shows, and I thought you guys were amazing. That original four-piece was great. Honest to God.
Yeah, it had its charm, but in that, there were many things that sort of going on that you wouldn't have known about, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly one of the last times we had played Lemoore's, the guitarist Dave Allison had his vision on, what we need to do, and mm-hmm. wasn't really what needed to be happening. Doing songs that we never ended up recording anyway. Overkill was opening up for us.
I think I remember that too. Honest to God.
Yeah, they got the deal and we didn't. Oh. I think it speaks for itself.
But anyway, let's go back in time like we've been doing anyway. Rob and you formed Gravestone in 1974. What did this band sound like as compared to Lips and Anvil?
Not a hell of a lot different, really. We began writing original music immediately, because mm-hmm. that's sort of what I do.
Yeah.
So some of those things were, I guess in those days, were more, a little bit more transparent as to where the influences came from, because we were just young. Very Sabbath-y oriented stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin oriented
mm-hmm.
sort of sounding material. Certainly not speed metal, at least not at that point.
No, I wouldn't think it would be. Well, the Hard and Heavy album was a mix of classic sounding hard rock and early heavy metal influenced by Ted Nugent, Grand Funk, and UFO. With the release of Metal on Metal and Forged in Fire, the style of the band had taken on a more thrash and speed metal direction at a time when very few bands were playing that style. What inspired Anvil to go in that musical direction?
Well, essentially, we had been all along. It's just in 81, we played with Motorhead.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a switch getting flipped, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That's the stuff.
Yeah, I think I
could easily relate to it because it's still rock and roll. It was still rock and roll based, but stepped up in sort of a higher velocity of attitude.
Mm-hmm. Well.
So that sort of set us in that direction. Plus, the up and coming stuff.
Mm-hmm.
At that particular time, it seemed like that's what we wanted. That seemed the most comfortable way to go.
I always thought of
it. I mean, it was previous to anybody doing it in North America, that's for sure. But the idea of playing fast certainly was. There are bands that began creating music like that, stem from Britain. We sort of came out at the end of the British wave of heavy metal and just before the beginning of the onslaught in the United States. So we sort of took what they did and brought it to a different level, and sort of what they did, but a little bit more intense.
Mm, yep.
Well, we had the goods in our band to do that.
Yeah.
So that made a big difference too. When you've got a monster drummer like that, you use it, and you exemplify those aspects of your sound, and that's what we did.
In 1982, after the release of Metal on Metal, Lemmy of Motorhead asked you to join, replacing Fast Eddie Clark. How did this come to be, and how did you feel about
being... They'd come to play a show in Toronto, and Eddie had a big blowout with the other rest of the guys in the band, and the day after the concert, we got a call from their management at the time asking me if I'd like to come and do the gig and finish the North American tour, maybe record an album. There was no real promises or guarantees of anything. They were desperately in need of somebody to take Eddie's place right there on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
And the first person that they thought of was me, because me being a big Motorhead fan and having an understanding of what they're doing, we were pretty much a first choice.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the circumstances didn't work out that way, because I was too busy. It was impossible to be in two places at once.
What do you think of Brian Robertson?
Great. I love Brian. Brian's great, man.
Yeah.
And I actually really loved that album that they did.
Oh, Another Perfect Day was great. That wasn't.
Unfortunately, it wasn't received well in its day. But then again, you could say the exact same thing about Forged in Fire.
Yeah, you can. But it was.
It was not received well in its day, and it was ahead of its time. Forged in Fire. That's really the case.
I pretty much agree with you, because that is one of my favorite Anvil albums.
Well, what in that day and age when David Krebs had all the labels come down to see us, I think we were playing with Zebra. We were playing with Zebra at the Palladium.
Oh yeah, you know what? I remembered that. I did see a fair amount.
All the labels were there. They came backstage and they're going.
It was about it. Yeah.
You guys are too heavy. You know, it's just too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't greeted with open arms, and it's.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the kind of things that happen. You get ahead of the pack, and people kind of going, what the hell's this?
Well, in 1983, after the release of Forged in Fire, like we talked about, Aerosmith manager David Krebs signed Anvil and convinced Attic Records to release the band from the contract. What actually happened, and why didn't it work out with him?
Because we couldn't license the first three albums, and in fact, they're still not licensable in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the nature of the business. Basically, what happened is the labels would have been willing to sign it, but they weren't willing to pay for it. Canadian label was not just going to hand this stuff over and say, here, go make money from our hard work and doing all the legwork and putting up all the capital to make this all happen. The labels weren't willing to pay any kind of serious money for the records, so they refused to license them.
Okay.
I mean, I don't blame them, but at the same time, it kiboshed our career in the way that when David finally pulled us out of the record contract, we couldn't get another record contract because the labels all wanted the earlier albums.
Guitarist Dave Allison sang lead vocals on Stop Me, on Metal on Metal, and on Forged in Fire he sang Never Deceive Me. Since you were the primary lead singer, what inspired you to let Dave sing on those tracks?
Well, we were Kiss fans, and we didn't think that, and at that time it wasn't that imperative that the lead vocalist has to sing all the songs, so we figured, why not?
Mm-hmm.
In retrospect, it was probably a mistake, because that actually boosted his ego to the point where he was commandeering the direction of the band, and we paid the price for that as well, so...
Yeah.
I mean, luckily, none of the material that he did sing after that point of time ever made it to light a day, and I'm grateful for that.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's the end of that, you know.
Okay.
After Strength of Steel, actually after Forge and Fire, I got quite a good grip on recognizing the downfall of going in that direction. And subsequently, on Strength of Steel, the only thing that he sang was sort of the other half of Straight Between the Eyes, which was trade-off vocals.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So in that particular case, he didn't sing another song again. So yeah. I recognize what happened at that Lemoore's that night when we let him up, and, you know, I'm receiving calls from all kinds of people going, how dare you ruin Anvil and let that piece of shit sing.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really...
It sounded
intense.
Pretty
people
devastating.
People get very, very passionate. Without any doubt, I mean, I recognize what that was. And that's why I'm saying, when you ask me what was the difference between the band in those days to now, I don't have to contend with those kind of things.
Yeah. No, I see what you're talking about.
And that level of confidence that I have today can't be compared.
Oh, yeah. Well, we all grow in some respect. All of us.
That's right.
Okay, well, in 1982, the band recorded Metal on Metal, and in 83, Anvil went back into the studio and recorded Forged in Fire. Both albums were recorded and produced by Chris Tsangarides. In 2007, like shown in the film, you went back in and recorded This Is 13 with Chris. What would you say is the biggest difference recording with him now as to back in 82 and 83?
Once again, the confidence level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when having to record Dave Allison and Ian Dixon, many of those tracks I had to do myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like Dave didn't play on Motormount. He didn't play on Winged Assassins. He didn't play on 666.
Wow.
Like all the speed metal stuff Dave didn't play on because basically he couldn't. Wasn't tight.
Wow, I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, people are going, you know, it's a four-piece band. Well, the real truth is it's been a three-piece band all along.
Oh, jeez. Oh,
pretty much.
Well, then I had a question about that, but you know what? Now I'm going to drop that one for you. But that was towards the end. Well, back in the day, you used to get on...
I mean, some of the saddest things were, like, as an example, even, like, if I think back to... some of the later albums that Ian Dixon still remained in the band, I'd actually replace his bass parts, and he never even noticed.
Jeez.
I didn't tell him, and I still never told him.
What? Well,
and he thinks it's him playing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what that says, but pretty bizarre, you know?
Yeah, I guess it is. Back in the day, you used to get on stage with a bondage harness and a vibrator. Where did you get the idea to get on stage with that getup?
I don't know, really. Well, basically, it was building towards it. In the earlier days, I mean, like I said, we were fans of Kiss, so and Ted Nugent. So certainly the studded wristbands.
Well,
you know, if we think back to Nugent with his, that was an inspiration, and certainly Paul Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it was a sign of the times. It was a trend of the times, and it just kind of evolved into that. And there was a leather shop in Toronto that I went into, and I kind of like, well, this looks pretty cool. And together with that, the other, and that's what it sort of ended up to be. But in it had a sort of a typecasting effect,
mm-hmm.
in a certain sense. And by the time 83 rolled around, I stopped wearing it.
Yeah.
And it would, every once in a while, it would get pulled out, used for specific shows. But generally speaking, I began wearing jeans with lots of zippers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which I still do now.
Wow.
It's much more regular. Although the vibrator came long before the bondage suit anyway. So, you know, the vibrator came up with, I mean, that was the whole concept that was behind the band,
mm-hmm.
at the time of when we called ourselves Lips. Everything was, all the songs were about sexual encounters.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything was had to do with sex. So the dildo was part of that. I mean, it was not just the dildo. There were things like nylons and panties hanging from the mic stands.
Oh, yeah. Well, you played a couple of shows down here when I used to go and see you guys play and see all of that. I thought it was hilarious, let's put it that way. And the music was great, and it fit really well with it.
Yeah, it was something. Yeah, I mean, you know, like, it's been said throughout musical history that when you combine the idea of sexual, some kind of sexuality and hard rock, it has a very, very flavorful thing about it. I mean, and that goes to be said about Jimi Hendrix humping his Strat against his Marshall stacks.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, I mean, I think it's always been there. Mm-hmm. Elvis Presley's pelvic thrust when he was singing, and mm-hmm. I think it's always been there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's part of what makes it
fun.
Part of the makings of what rock and roll is.
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, in the early 80s, Anvil played on the bill with Metallica, Slayer, and Anthrax at clubs like L'Amour's in Brooklyn, New York. But around the same time, the band would tour Europe and Japan playing festival shows like the 1982 Monsters of Rock Festival held on August 21st, 1982, which featured Status Quo, Gillan, Saxon, Hawkwind, and Uriah Heep. Or the Super Rock Festival in Japan, held on August 11th or 12th, 1984, with Bon Jovi and Whitesnake, to name a few. How would you compare playing with upstarts in club settings to playing a big stage with some of the legends of rock?
They were opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like we got to do that all the time. It was we got lucky. I mean, basically, David Krebs, as far as Super Rock 84, but at that point in time, there was really, you know, he's going, well, I'll play a couple of your tunes. Maybe one of the Japanese labels might want to do something for you, but basically, my hands are tied. I can't do much for you, but I'm going to give you this opportunity to go out and play.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the last time we had dealings with him. And that's the way that kind of
mm-hmm.
happened.
Okay.
The Monsters of Rock Donington Festival was an extraordinary expense to Attic Records.
Yeah.
Went against our red line, of course. I'm still paying for that to this day.
Oh, God. Great,
I mean,
bill.
That's the essence of how it works.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a real record company and they pay for you to get you there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you're paid to get there. They pay for you to get there.
Of course, I know that.
That's the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the only way that you're going to get paid to be there is when you've actually already made it.
Okay.
When you become a commodity. So in those days, we had those opportunities given to us by Attic Records, but at the same time, it redlined us to the point where 20 years later, we still haven't recouped.
Well, I think you're on your way to recoup.
Well, I mean, they make let's face it, it's record company business. They make the numbers dance on the page, and basically it's nothing less than loan sharking, where they make 10 times the amount of profit before you see a nickel.
Yeah.
And that's just the nature of the business, you know, so.
Okay.
Those are the realities of it.
Okay. Well, in 1987, Anvil signed to Metal Blade Records, releasing three albums, Strength of Steel in 87, Pound for Pound in 88, and Past and Present Live. The band brought in a new producer, Paul Acciapella. How would you compare working with him to Sanger?
Paul didn't produce those records. He's an engineer who owns Quest Studios, where we recorded our first album.
Mm-hmm.
And we just all, basically what we did is we went into a studio on the cuff and recorded those records.
Oh, okay. Because it says
a credit. What was that?
It says a credit to him.
That?
Yeah, I mean, it says a credit to him on some of those. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, he was the engineer. I don't know how much he really produced anything.
okay, forget.
You know, that's another issue, I suppose. He got the credit, but he didn't really do much other than engineer the records.
What was your impression of the mid-80s thrash and speed metal movement? What did you think of the success of Metallica and Megadeth?
I don't know. I kind of didn't really pay attention to it. It's not my
band. Well, it was a
either.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not particularly a big fan of. I'm not a big my most of my influences come from the earlier stuff.
Of course. Well, so does mine actually.
It just seemed to me that they were doing what we were doing, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to be influenced sort of my own influence.
Tell you the truth, I always thought that there was a huge mistake, and I thought that Anvil should have made it way before Metallica.
When you haven't got record companies or any kind of management, you're not going to make it. I don't care how good you are or how influential.
Mm-hmm.
You are, or what you've brought to the table.
Yeah.
If you haven't got the people working for you, you're going nowhere, man.
In 1991, Maximum Records released "Worth the Wait," which featured Sebastian Marino on guitar, the only American to play with Anvil, replacing Dave Allison. What was it like playing with Marino, as compared to Allison? And how would you compare playing with?
It was a much different situation. It was actually legitimately the first time we'd had a second guitarist, really.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, he was very green.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of growing pains having him in the band. Certainly sorting his sound out, trying to fit him in properly. He didn't have the experience to know certain aspects of what needed to happen, and it was a lot of learning experience and painful for me.
Mm-hmm.
On the level that here's this great guitar player who hasn't got the first clue as to what it means to play with a band, really, and work as a team member. And at the end of the day, it was that sort of attitude that ended his career with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he got offered something else and ran to it because he thought there was money.
Yeah, he went to Overkill.
At the end of the day, there wasn't what he thought it was, and now he's friends with us. He does sound, and he's no longer really a guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was really in his heart. You know, still, it was okay, but still not quite where it needed to get to.
In 1993, longtime bassist Ian Dixon left the band, being replaced by Mike Duncan. Were you surprised by his departure?
No, not at all. Ian had lost a lot of faith in what he was doing. He became quite disinterested in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
He actually gave us almost a two-year warning that he was going to quit.
Wow.
So by the time Sebastian joined the band, he was already talking about leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he used the excuse, I'm sick and tired of sitting and waiting to play.
Mm-hmm. Why did Mike Duncan leave after the recording of Plugged In Permanent, and why wasn't he credited on that album?
Because he didn't write any of the songs, and he became a real pain in the ass. You know? Also, inexperience, you know, those kind of things. I made mistakes.
Yeah, well.
And who I hired. It's as simple as that. I mean, what am I going to say?
Okay. Well,
you know, I'm glad he didn't work out because we ended up with Glenn.
Yeah, who's great, actually.
It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that the two previous guys didn't have, this guy has, and that much more. So I think it worked out absolutely exemplary from my perspective.
The cover of your albums have always been very memorable, to me at least. Especially your Plugged In Permanent album, which features an anvil smashed into an acoustic guitar. Was this meant to mock MTV Unplugged releases at that time? And where
Absolutely.
Do you guys... I figured so. And where do you guys
Absolutely.
Come up with...
That's the whole point. It's like everybody's putting out acoustic albums and we're going, what a waste.
Where do you guys come up with your unique album cover ideas?
I don't really know. They're just thought of, you know. There's as much time and effort put into those things as into the music. So, you know, it's not like you flippantly just, well, you know, we'll come up with this, throw it out there. You look for just the right thing, you know, and that's what we do. The conceptual, you know, it's not just as simple as coming up with something.
Mm-hmm. No, I always loved them. Each one of them had an anvil on it. I thought they were really funny, and the way they were like that plugged in permanent is just like something that's like etched in my brain.
Yeah, and absolutely no alternative, the crushing of radios.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're all great. Have you ever felt that if you started out today, the web would have made it easier?
Absolutely not. I think it's way harder now.
Really?
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. Anybody and everybody can record a record for virtually nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no publicity, so how do you get it out there?
What about MySpace?
What about it?
I mean...
There's 100 million MySpace fans, so what? What draws them to your page?
Of course. Have you ever heard of the many music-based meetup groups in New York?
No. But I still have serious doubt. There's absolutely no filtering. So, like I said, anybody can record. So you get complete no talents out there making records. How do you discern one from the other? The audience is extraordinarily fragmented. I think it's way harder to make it now.
Yeah, I almost agree with you on that. I mean, if you saw what
look at the situation with Amble. Basically, they made a full on movie, not just a basic silly DVD, but a full on movie that played in movie theaters. And even after all that, you still only get a handful of offers from record companies. Basically, we've made it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they come to the table. So I think it's way, way, way more difficult.
Well,
way more difficult. Not even comparable to the old days when there used to be A&R departments of record companies that would be able to at least discern the good from bad.
Mm-hmm.
Records would get actually produced by producers and in real recording studios.
Of course.
You know, the sound quality of those records are far and beyond anything that is being produced these days on a multitude of reasons. First of all, digital recording doesn't compare to analog.
Of course.
Particularly for hard metal and
for any kind of hard rock.
Particularly for the recording of drums.
Oh yeah, definitely.
The introduction of sampled drums, all those kind of things, completely kind of deteriorated what we have known. The talent has deteriorated. There's the things like with Pro Tools and all that stuff. quantizers, not only quantizing, if the drummer moved in tempo, you press a button and now it's all perfect, like a...
Yeah, I agree with you.
Vocals being slightly out of tune, which in a certain sense gave vocalists originally their style.
Mm-hmm.
That gets removed because you press a button and now the guy's singing perfectly in tune, and it loses the characters and sort of style. And
oh, yeah.
And because of the an extraordinary amount of redundancy in style, everybody trying to copy the guy in front of them rather than
trying to be original.
Something new. Yeah.
Well, this
in the
this...
early '80s, in order to get a record deal, you have to be different from each
mm-hmm.
other. Otherwise, you wouldn't get signed. That well, doesn't exist anymore. So it makes this big, huge mishmash
of crap.
Of crap.
I'm agreeing with you 100% because this is what I've been saying all along.
You know, so when somebody asks me, is it easier to make it these days? No.
Okay.
Definitely not. And what is making it? That's almost questionable.
Yeah. I'm almost wondering. The band seemed to stabilize lineup changes between 97 and 2007. Was that just a stroke of good luck, or was that the band trying to go out of its way in order to maintain a solid consistency in the face of various struggles?
I think it just found itself. I mean, basically, there's no... I mean, other than the departure of Ivan, which he wasn't fired, and
no.
He didn't really quit. He just kind of faded away. I worked very hard to keep him in the circle, but he didn't have the desire.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody doesn't have the desire, they fade away, and that's exactly what happened. I just got sick and tired of chasing him to come to rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
And it became ridiculous to chase somebody who doesn't want to be there.
Yeah.
You know, Glenn and I and Rob would write all the songs, and it seemed really peculiar. Why is this guitar player here? He doesn't even know the songs. When we got to England to record This Is 13, Ivan didn't know any of the songs.
Jeez.
Even when I called him after I found out we were going to do the work with Chris, I called him and I said, look it, man, Chris has worked with Yngwie Malmsteen. You'd better be prepared when we go in there. When we got to England, he was completely unprepared, totally unprepared, had not come to rehearsal, did not know the songs, did not play on the album.
Wow.
So I had left three open spaces for him to play lead guitar on. It took him 3 days. It took me 3 days to play the other 10 songs, all the solos. And it
Jeez.
Took him 3 days to do 2.5 guitar solos. I was fed up. Whenever we'd play a new song, he'd shut his amp off and pretend he was playing. So people are listening to a three-piece band. They're not even realizing the guy's not playing.
Wow.
And it's like, enough of this.
Yeah.
So I just stopped calling him. About 6 months later, I get a call from him on my cell phone, and he says, I'm going to come pick up my gear. Is that okay?
Boy, oh boy.
And that was the end of Ivan, and there was virtually no pain or transitional period. We were used to being a three-piece, so it's like, let's just go out like we always have been.
Yeah.
And let the world see us for what we really are, rather than this, you know, with this
three-piece.
Cosmetic
yeah.
application.
Yeah.
Having a fourth guy standing there, what the hell for?
Okay.
Forget it. You know, so we went and we played the newer Lemours.
Yeah.
And we set up, and of course Ivan wasn't there, and no one even... It wasn't until after the set, people came up and go, weren't you guys a four-piece?
Well, for the longest time, you were.
Yeah, and people, most people didn't even mention that. It was actually the club owner comes up to me, you pulled it off, Lips. And I go, what's that? He goes, you came in here as a three-piece, and you never told anybody, and everybody loved the band. You pulled it off. So I go to him, no, man, I've been pulling it off for fucking 2 decades, man. You know, it's just that the guy was standing there not doing anything.
That's pretty amazing. On your 1997 Absolutely No Alternative album, you had a song called Old School. Was this the band's way of reminiscing about its past, or was that in the song Real Metal?
In a certain sense, yes. In a certain sense, it was a revisitation to to the song Jackhammer.
Yeah.
And I purposely did that. It's a different riff, obviously, but the somewhat the structure of the song and the way that it worked was reminiscent of that, and that's what I was kind of aiming at doing.
Okay. Well, you also have a song like that called Real Metal on your 2001 release of Plenty of Power.
Right.
Yeah, I just kind of remember I was kind of trying to tie that in. But I've always found your lyrics to be very descriptive, especially in two songs off the Plenty of Power album, one called The Creep and another one called Disgruntled. I was just wondering what those songs were about, because they sound really nasty. Like, this guy doesn't sound like a real nice guy.
Well, the song The Creep was about this, about an agent that booked our a U.S. tour in 98.
Mm-hmm.
Might have been 99, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a real
creep.
Real piece of work, man.
And
so
what
kind of wrote it about him? It's the kind of guy that comes in with a long trench coat on and you almost expect him to open it up and he's not wearing anything underneath it.
And what about
the coked out and wasted, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just a creepy kind of character.
And what about Disgruntled?
He didn't give a shit about anything else but his commission and whatever we had to go through for him to make his money. He couldn't give a damn.
And what about Disgruntled?
Disgruntled. One day Rob said that word, and I started giggling. I thought it was I got a kick out of it. I thought, you know, postal, going postal, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Being disgruntled, you know. Just basic fundamental emotion.
Since your first album, Hard and Heavy, the title of each album besides the anthology and Backwax contains two words beginning with the same letter. Whose idea was that?
Well, that kind of wrote itself. When we were called Lips, we had called the album Hard and Heavy, and when we actually changed the name to Anvil, it actually made a lot more sense calling the band Anvil with the title Hard and Heavy.
In the story of Anvil, the story of Anvil documentary, Rob was telling Chris that the band had 19 songs, and you guys wanted to put 13 songs on your This Is 13 album.
Right.
Is the remaining 6 songs going to be part of your next album, Juggernaut of Justice?
No.
No. So what happened to those 6 songs?
They just got scrubbed. I'm not going to use them.
Okay. I just figured.
Simple as that, you know? They didn't make the cut. There's a reason for it. Why labor over it, or why worry about it? Just dump them and forget you ever had them.
Okay. I just figured.
They're just songs, man.
Yeah, well,
You'll write another one.
You'll write another one. That's true.
Well, that's the way it is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's all dispensable unless you spend the money on it.
Why did you guys decide to re-record Metal on Metal in 666?
Because we had to. For Rock Band.
Oh, it was... Oh, geez.
The original recordings don't exist anymore, and they needed all the 24 tracks, so we had to re-record it. So the other aspect is the company that those original recordings went to, they want huge amounts of money to license them, like I told you at the beginning.
So yeah.
Every time we'd have to use Metal on Metal, we have to use the original and pay a fortune for the use of it.
And that kind of...
Now we don't have to anymore.
Yeah. Well, I guess you want to put the current lineup stamp on it anyway. Put Glenn's stamp on it.
Well, that's not so much the issue as the finances for it.
Mm-hmm.
the song still remains the same, and it still virtually sounds the same.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, it's the same band, same singer, same drummer,
mm-hmm.
the same lead guitarist. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Did AC/DC like you guys when you opened some shows for them at Giant Stadium and in Massachusetts? And did you have any interaction with them?
No real interaction. I met Angus, shook his hand, and thanked him for being there.
Mm-hmm.
He thought we were terrific, and it was his pleasure to have us there.
I guess I asked you all the questions. I wanted to thank you for the interview. I wanted to thank you for spending the time to answer all my questions, and that's it.
Okay, have a good day.
You too.
All right, bye-bye.